Hello, everyone. We just wanted to make a short recording to let everybody know about this new way of conducting peer-to-peers and how you can learn to win more peer-to-peers. And you can do it without all the hype. You don't need a bunch of software. You don't need much of anything. But if you don't have time to do it, you can hire Glenn and Jake to do it. But I'm going to let Glenn and Jake talk about this because we put together a little brochure, and we'll send that out to people because there's basically four things that Jake talks about is a way that he is able to win so many peer-to-peers. And a lot of times you don't have time to do all that work that Jake and Glenn can do, so you just hire them, and I'll let them tell you how that works. But Jake, go ahead, because I think there were four things that you said about how it is that you focus on being able to win a peer-to-peer easier than ever before.
Okay, Ernie, thank you so much. I think I've got more than four bullet points, but I want to go through this. I was trained into this area by UR department because they had situations where peer-to-peer calls were needed, and the attending physician was either off service or otherwise unavailable. So that's how I got trained into it. I had no special training or no special prior experience. And I had to sort of go into this thing, wade into the shallow end of the pool and then swim to the deeper end. There is no secret sauce. There's an old adage that says when preparation meets opportunity, success ensues. And that's sort of what it is. It's just hard work. It's a replicatable process. Each process may be specific to the physician. I will describe what I have used. Others may think about using it. It has worked well for me. Since I have been employing this process, I can overturn about 80 to 90% of the level of care downgrades. And that also includes those that did not meet interqual criteria at times. And so also many that are less than 48 hours of inpatient stay.
Well, that's definitely an above average win rate.
It sure is.
So prior to the peer-to-peer calls, again, it's a process. You have to, and Ernie and Glenn know that communication, it's not always what you say when you communicate, it's how you say it. And what I like to do is I like to try to understand the person on the other end of the call. If I know who the physician is, the medical director for the insurance carrier, I will actually do a search. I will look in LinkedIn. I will look in health grades, WebMD, anywhere their credentials and experience may be displayed so that I kind of have a feeling for who I'm talking to. Then I review, I complete a review template. It's something that I developed. It's certainly not, it's unique to me, but it doesn't preclude other approaches. And what I look at, and Glenn and I have talked about this for years, every patient has a clinical story, and it will inevitably have subplots, which are associated with the generation of one or more medical conditions, diagnoses. And by the end of the patient story, each subplot and the associated diagnosis or diagnoses must have been accounted for. And there may have been subplot twists, i.e. a provisional diagnosis may have been eliminated or may have resolved. This should be communicated clearly. And this is when we talk and teach physicians on clinical documentation. We need to know the fate of each of those subplots. And this will usually result in a clinically continuous and cogent account of the patient's journey from admission to discharge. And it leaves the reader content that there are no missing pieces or loose ends. If we have no missing pieces or loose ends and we have a clinically continuous story, that patient story, we typically don't get denials of any type.
That's right.
Certainly not level of care. So what do we want to look at as reviewers to try to reflect medical necessity for a heightened level of care? Well, in my opinion, I recommend that the physician each day put a statement in the note to clearly delineate why an inpatient level of care is medically necessary. And that can be supported in the record by factors such as the history and comorbidities, the clinical severity of signs and symptoms, the patient's current medical needs, and finally, the risk of adverse events absent that heightened level of care. So those are the things we teach the residents and the hospitalist. And then we review the notes daily for inflection points. One, I look at interval history. Is it clear why the patient still requires an inpatient level of care? I.e., is the severity of illness and the intensity of services clearly delineated? If I see something that says no new complaints, no significant adverse events overnight and doing well, that's not helpful to me because that tells the external reviewer that this patient probably doesn't need to have an inpatient level.
So, Dr. Martin, may I make a comment? And I see that all the time. No new events, patient doing well, patient stable. And that beckons the question for you are, how do I work with the case manager, or you are on the other side to address and allow the patient to be authorized for additional days. As soon as you put down no new events, patient stable, no complaints, resting comfortably, that's the end of authorization.
It really is, and it's an uphill battle to make a counter argument to that effect.
Absolutely.
And when you see that, I make a mental note. For that day, I'm going to go look at tabulated data, vital signs, laboratory, infusions, et cetera, because no significant adverse events overnight, that oftentimes is not the case. It's just that they were not communicated in the subsequent note. And the patient is stable now. But they're stable now because they had 2 liters of normal saline bolused once each twice through the night because they became hypotensive.
Didn't you have a case like that, Dr. Martin?
Yes, I did. And it was a level of care downgrade. And when I brought that out to the medical director of the insurance carrier, it was an overturn. But if you just look at the notes, which is what the medical directors will look at for the carriers, they're not going to see that because they're not going to do the deep dive into the tabulated data. The next thing I look at is the daily plan. Are the evaluations and or treatments being provided which require increased monitoring? Examples are left heart cath, cardioversion procedures, infusions. For example, if there's a neurological issue, Q hourly neuro checks. Is there continuous cardiac monitoring owing to arrhythmias or a significant risk for arrhythmias? So those are some of the areas we look at. Next are medical comorbidities giving rise to elevated real medical risk. And Glenn and I'll see this in records. We'll see whether there are chronic medical conditions which are interactive. They may interact with each other, or they may interact or provide increased risk for the acute conditions for which the patient is presenting. Next, are there social determinants of health which elevate risk? Because that is oftentimes overlooked. So you want to check that. There may be a problem that this person doesn't have transportation, or they've lost insurance coverage for their antihypertensives, or they're in between coverages, and they're not on medications, and they're just simply blanket listed as noncompliant. Sometimes they're not noncompliant by choice. And so we want to look at things like that. Do they have a safe area to live? Do they have a stable living situation? Are they at risk by their dwelling or by others? Then after completion of my template, 6 to 8 talking points are extracted. And these are the key issues which will be discussed with the insurance carrier medical director. This provides for a fluid, efficient, and focused discussion. And then I ask, are there any other questions? Because I have things color-coded on my review template so that I can get quick visual acquisition, because I know the areas they're going to ask. I had the fortune of being in the insurance industry as a medical reviewer for almost 13 years. So I've been on the other side of the telephone. This is the other thing. And Glenn and I have talked about this. When you approach these types of things, I choose to approach them in a collegial fashion to be professional. Oftentimes doctors feel like, you know, I've been challenged. They may approach it with a defensive attitude, and it doesn't take long before that then degenerates into really not a good situation, not great communication. It becomes an adverse situation, and it may actually affect the outcome. But these are physicians. They're screened in order to get these positions that they have. They're well trained. Many of them are still practicing physicians. And I spoke with one last week who told me, he said, look, he said, this happens to me. He said, I get level of care downgrades. And he says, I know what I should have in the record. So he said, you know, this is a learning process. And it becomes interactive, it becomes collegial, it becomes professional. And when the call terminates, I always thank them for their time because they have a long call queue. They have to get through it as well as do their review queue. So they're under the gun as well. And this works for me because I am not the attending physician and I have time to complete this process. This is a labor intensive process. It's a detail oriented process. It's a drill down into the record process. It's a leave no stone unturned process. And the attending physicians simply do not have time to do that. They're about the business of discovering what's brought someone in the hospital and efficaciously and expediently managing that problem or problems. I have the luxury of having that time to accord the review and to set this thing up into a process that's really organized and creates a really efficient discussion with the medical directors of the carriers.
I think that's the key thing, is that you have the time and the knowledge and the experience to take care of these things. And I think y'all are going to put up a course to teach this kind of stuff as well, right?
Yes, and we've got live case studies, fully redacted, but live case studies. Mm-hmm. And Ernie, you know, I always say, if you have the attending physician, that is the physician who knows the patient best.
Absolutely.
But sometimes they're caught unawares. They're caught off guard. They're just said, hey, there's a call for you. They're in between patients, or they may have gone to the emergency room and got a new admit. And they don't have all this at their fingertips. They're going from memory maybe a week or two earlier.
That's right. That's right.
They're at a disadvantage. So this is certainly not a slam against the attending physicians, because they're the ones on the front line. They are the operational elements. We're the support elements.
Yeah, and I think there's a, you know, you guys make it not, you know, you can easily overcome these denials, but you also make it easy for the hospitals to be able to afford you guys, right?
Yes. I don't know how other folks have priced this out, but it's just part of my regular day with the hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a specific type thing that, you know, it's not like an add-on or something like that. It's just something I would do in the course of the day with the hospital. But I'm not sure of pricing structures in other cases, but I've talked to folks, and this is anecdotal only, this is not a statistical inference, but I have talked to other folks, and we're kind of the bargain basement people to do this.
Well, if you think about 80 to 90% overturn rate, I've been in this business, Ernie, for 32 years, kind of dates myself, but you're lucky if you, I think an average number is maybe 45-50%, because that's a good number. Oftentimes, you know, Dr. Martin, oftentimes what happens is they set it, the UR department sets up the peer-to-peer, they give you a window, okay, you can't, and the physician hospitalist who's working 20 accounts, 20 patients, and has two admissions waiting in the ED, they can't stand around waiting for the medical director to call. They may call 2 hours after they're supposed to, and either they're not available or they're in a situation where they're not in front of the computer. That's one of the challenges, Dr. Martin.
I totally agree, and that's why I really like to do this type of work, because one, as I said, Ernie, I'm a support element. I'm not the tip of the spear. I'm just the guy in the hardware area that sharpens the spear. But I like to do that, and I take it under the guise that I have a fiduciary responsibility to the hospital, and I take these calls very seriously. And I don't want to leave any stone unturned. I do not want to create a false impression. But when you have a good relationship with the medical director of the insurance carrier, you both have a shared motive. You want to follow the documented medical evidence and go where it leads. And if you do that, you may not overturn every time, but you've done the right thing. You haven't let anything fall through the cracks.
And you know,
one thing I think that makes you guys totally different from everybody else out there doing this kind of work that I know of at the moment, and I think it's that you've been saying, if you take on the case and you don't win, you don't charge them anything. You don't charge the hospital for it if you don't win.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old concept, you eat what you kill.
Yeah. So,
well, you know, you think about it, Ernie and Dr. Martin, you have, I'm not badgering other companies, but if I'm a CFO and I say, I'm going to charge you X number of dollars, whether we win or not, okay, that's putting gas on a fire. You've already downgraded to a observation. Average payment in the country for observation, all payers, is about 3,000. The average payment for an inpatient is 10 grand. Okay, so now if I don't win, not only do I missed out on that 7,000, I pay $400. So now my 3,000 is only 20 is now $2,600.
Yeah, and that's true. And I don't know the process that other companies use, but I just think that in the end of the day, whoever does this, if you're chosen or if you're directed to do it, if you have the time, develop your own process.
Right.
Feel comfortable in it. And the old total quality management scheme, you know, implement it. Observe, analyze, and then retweak as needed, because nothing is ever the beginning and the end. You know, there will be times that I will change up just a little bit, but the key areas I've talked about, they're going to remain the same. But, you know, these are educational calls for me. I learn from the medical directors. I learn from their process. No two medical directors, even for the same insurance carrier, are the same. They have the same fund of knowledge clinically, but the way they approach it may not be the same. And I've actually had some medical directors try to assist me in finding ways to overturn. You know,
these are folks. No, that's unusual. Think about it.
It is unusual, but you know, that's when you have a good relationship with them, and they know that you're not trying to you know, pull some sort of fast action on them. They respect what you do and what you tell them, and you mutually respect what they say and
right.
what they do.
Hey, Dr. Ma, don't you sometimes have a case that's weak, and you'll bring it, you know, you'll accept the down the you affirm the down code level of care downgrade. But every, and I think one of the most important things that Dr. Martin does, and I'm not patronizing him truly, but I've been working with Dr. Martin since what, 1997, Dr. Martin?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a long time. We've been to over 100 hospitals, and I really like his method, which aligns with mine, is to engage the client in process improvement. What can you do? Moving forward to avoid or alleviate some of these self-inflicted denials? Because Dr. Martin, would you say some of these cases you review, the documentation could have been strengthened? Not more documentation, more effective documentation of the clinical judgment.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, sometimes it's expedient. Sometimes it's an unintended consequence of the electronic health record.
Right.
Things get in there that shouldn't be in there because they're either populated, pre-populated, or they're carried forward. And, you know, you and I see things like that all the time. And if
absolutely.
You sit down, if you just had time to have a cup of coffee with a doctor and they just shake their heads, how'd that get there? You know, because they're
and that happens. That happens. I asked the doctor, why did you put down lutetium times three? The patient, I look at the nurses, and also gasped me for air. He says, oh, that must have been, I must have copied and pasted that.
You know, and it at the time, it seems benign, but I've always, and this is a story for another day, but we talk about copy, paste, review, and edit.
That's right.
The copy and paste functionality is certainly improved the expediency of records, but it also some at times, and not rarely, increased the inaccuracy of records and the errors in records, which sometimes can affect patient safety and patient outcomes. So
it has, So it has some dangers associated. Well, let's stop this one for now. And I want to tell everybody, listen, if you want to know more about this from Jake and Glenn, you just go to core-cdi.com and you can find links to get a hold of them and be able to be alerted when they get education that comes out or more announcements or more case studies, and you can get all of that. So that's at
Yeah, and Ernie, there's a place on my website to sign up for newsletters. I'm going to be posting just next, hopefully by tomorrow, waiting for my webmaster. There are 17 preferred KPIs that all CFOs and CDI directors and VPs of revenue cycle should use, because there's a LinkedIn post on my website that is titled, "Is CFOs Being Hoodwinked or Misled by Current KPIs?" It elicited a lot of responses, but some of them were not that good on LinkedIn, Ernie. But it's worth reading.
Okay, well, I want to remind everybody again, you go to core-cdi.com and you can find that kind of material. And I think I'm also going to post it on myfinallyfinally.com.
Absolutely.
And so thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Glenn.
Oh, you're welcome.
And
thank you, Ernie.
We look forward to helping other people win it so they can learn how to win more peer-to-peer calls.
Thank you, Ernie.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Ernie.